Well, I don't know what you made of the summer and what kind of a holiday you made. My wife Claire and I got away and we had a great varied time. We enjoyed a walk along the Yorkshire Moors, wonderful scenery. You suddenly realise that great though it is, Regent's Park isn't actually much compared with that. We enjoyed coffee with some friends up in Sheffield. I went shopping with her. And she decided in the end that I ought to stay in touch with my masculine side. So we went to see a film together, and we enjoyed the latest in the Bourne series, the Bourne Legacy. You know, mindless, violent fun for a couple of hours. I don't know how many people got shot dead, but it was great. You may know the series. The first of them was the Bourne Identity. Jason Bourne, Matt Damon starred as him in the beginning of these, a highly trained assassin. And the plot of the Bourne Identity, much of it was Bourne discovering who he was and staying alive long enough to do so. Amnesia, no memory, a case full of passports with different names, considerable resources being poured into stopping him discovering his true identity. No wonder that who am I was a question designed to confuse him. And in real life, of course, we face the who am I question every day. And it's easy enough to answer at one level, isn't it? You know, I'm Hugh Palmer, I'm the husband of Claire, I'm father to Anna, Lucy and Mark. And if you press me a bit further for more significance, I'll probably fall back on the usual safety net and assume the question means, what do I do? And then I can say I'm the rector of All Souls Langham Place. I mean, for so many of us, and for so much of our lives, our work, and even our work title, shapes our identity. How we think of ourselves, how others think of us. And life has a way of confusing and destroying those levels of identity with various sort of randomly different tools, doesn't it? Redundancy, that puts a spanner in the works. Retirement, now I've got to face the question again. Illness, death, divorce, they can all leave me struggling with who am I? The actor Peter Sellers' biography was called The Man Behind the Mask, and the author wrote that Peter Sellers played so many roles he sometimes wasn't sure of his own identity. Approached once by a fan who asked him, "Are you Peter Sellers?" Sellers answered briskly, "Not today," and walked on. Well, I find the deepest, richest, securest identity in this famous chapter, John chapter 1. It looks at history and it helps me look at myself through God's lenses. The chapter, as you know, speaks of the Word, Jesus. And it's all leading up to what it says there in verse 12. You see it? "Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." Planting the family of God in a world of darkness, that's what history is about. That's what God is about. And to know myself a child of God, that is the profoundest privilege and the richest identity anyone could possibly have. But there's not often a rush to claim it, is there? This identity is what I've called the unwanted identity. And that's what verses 9 to 12 are indicating. They are extraordinary verses. And frankly, they undermine any idea that this is a made-up story, because if we were going to make up the story of God coming to his world, his earth, it wouldn't run like this. I mean, you wouldn't make it up this way. Actually, it gives the lie to other ideas too, the thought that God doesn't care, and if he cared a bit more, as someone put it, perhaps we might follow him. The truth is, he does care. He cared enough to come into the world to rescue, and when he did, we were the ones who couldn't be bothered. See, look at verse 9. "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him." It's not like you passing the Langham Hilton and the screaming girls, as Charmaine referred to them, and seeing the guy walking in and thinking, "Who is that they're all screaming at?" And certainly not like you being told it's Justin Bieber and thinking, "Who's he?" which really does damage your street cred. Now, this is actually blanking someone you do know in the street. This is like, oh, I don't know, explaining the design of All Souls to John Nash as if he were a tourist and not the man who built the place. See, it gets worse, verse 11. He came to that which was his own, and in this context that must mean, I think, the Jewish people. The people he'd called out, he'd rescued, he'd kept, he'd guarded, he'd revealed himself to, he'd given his laws to, he'd prepared for this coming Messiah. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive it. Now that's gutting, isn't it? His own didn't receive it. There's a very British idea about receive, isn't there? You know how committees can receive a report? Which sounds very affirming, but doesn't actually mean anyone agrees with the word in it. It just means they acknowledge it's there. This doesn't even have that veneer of politeness, though, because as the history unfolds, you discover they turned their backs, they plotted against, they crucified him. We shouldn't sound too shocked, actually, and we certainly shouldn't start to pointing fingers. Here in the UK, we've enjoyed the gospel of Jesus for centuries. We've known its privileges. We've allowed it to shape our life and our culture and our laws. We've prided ourselves on them. And now, at best, we pay Christ lip service in the public square. Sometimes hardly even that. And government lawyers say, if you can't wear a cross at work, well, you can wear it in private, so that's fine. And if you can't live as a Christian in your job, it doesn't infringe your qualities because you can always resign and get another one. It's been an extraordinary summer, hasn't it, with the Olympics? Did you go to it? People been? You missed something that was fabulous. Just worth going to the experience. Never mind the sport. Some of them, you know, what sports were. Well, anyway, look, if you go back to the 1936, the Berlin Olympics, some of you will remember it. When Jesse Owens won his 4 gold medals, the story went round that Hitler was furious at a Negro winning so many golds at his Aryan games that he stormed out and refused to shake hands with him. The truth is that when Jesse Owens got home, after a ticker tape parade in New York City in his honour, he went to a reception at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, also in his honour. But to get to it, he was made to travel in the service lift, not the guest lift, because he was black. He was never invited to the White House, and Jesse Owens said, "Hitler didn't snub me, Roosevelt did. The president never even sent me a telegram." He came to his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet, verse 12 goes on, to all who did receive him. And the word's a strong one. It means take hold of him, Jesus. To those who believed in his name, his character, his person. It's far more than a nodding of a head and a sort of doffing of the cap in acknowledgement of Jesus. This faith's dynamic. There's a sense of movement. It's belief into his name. It's not just standing at the bus stop and seeing a bus go by and say, oh yes, that bus is going home. It's getting onto it. For those who will be identified with Jesus like that, he gave the right to become children of God. This unwanted identity, it's the greatest privilege we can have. Edward comes from the Sudan, a country where the law specifies the death penalty for apostates from Islam. His uncle converted to Christianity, and Edward got hold of a Bible to read it so that he could argue against his uncle, and was converted by it. His family began to spot the difference. They decided not to have me arrested, but I still had to leave my parents' house immediately and sign a statement renouncing all claims that I had as the eldest and only son to any kind of inheritance. I also had to drop out of university because as a convert to Christianity, I no longer had a right to study there. My friends shunned me. It was very difficult for me to live without family in a country where the family is of the utmost importance. And I had to learn to trust God totally. It was then, and is still, a great comfort to me to know that though I no longer had an earthly family, I belong now to a much greater family and to a God whom I may call Father. The unwanted identity, which is actually the universal right. See, people are always offering salvation, aren't they, for some. You know, there are philosophies for the intelligent, mysticism for the initiated, religion for the moral, and the Jewish faith centered on those from the right ethnic pedigree. So don't read verse 12 as if it's normal, as if it's water off a duck's back. Yet to all, regardless of age, gender, race, moral background, you just got to turn a page and you'll come to Nicodemus, the respectable pillar of the religious in-crowd in chapter 3. And turn another page and you'll find yourself face to face with the Samaritan woman, the shady outcast, the morally as well as religiously dubious foreigner in chapter 4. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. For a religion that's often thought of as very exclusive, this is massively inclusive talk. And in a world and society where rank and status mean so much and so many were slaves with so few rights and so little freedom, imagine having in your hands the right to be in personal relationship within the family circle of God himself. The right to become children of God. And it's no different today. I mean, every society has its haves and have-nots, whether it comes from class or caste or meritocracy or whatever. And so many of us live our lives, don't we, under the shadow of how others value us or don't value us. It can be true in the family. It can be very true in the workplace. It can be tragically true even in church. And yet here's the right to become children of God. I mean, look at it. Treasure it. Meet the put down with this identity. For some of us, it's how we value ourselves that demoralizes and diminishes us. The crippling lack of self-worth that we experience, even sadly in Christian communities. I wonder if we've learnt yet one of the keys of discipleship, to preach to ourselves. To take a verse like verse 12. To read it to myself, to repeat it to myself, to counter my negative thoughts and others' sneers with God's verdict on me, his promise to me as a believer, I am a child of God. And for those of us who have it all and still want more, now look at it. What greater security do I want than the child of God? What greater status can I imagine than the child of God? When our family, when our education, when our career assume a greater value for us or for our ambitions for our children than the right to become children of God, we need to preach to ourselves too and do it urgently. When you go back to work after lunch, as you enter the office or whatever it is that's your workplace, what identity do you take in with you? You walk back in as the manager, the consultant, the secretary, or do you also think, and a child of God? And a child of God. It's what will keep you in perspective. So many of us as Brits, we've lived for so long taking so many of our rights for granted and assuming they'll be there if we ever need them. My fear is that people treat this spiritual right the same way. It's there, sort of filed away as one of those comforting promises in amongst a pile of spiritual baggage we carry around with us in our briefcases. And the question is, will we leave it like that? Or will we live it? Will we live it? Will it remain a vague comfort, or will we take it out and examine it and see it for the amazing privilege it is, the one right, the one identity I can take through the whole of my life and even to the grave, and it'll still give me something to look forward to? The right to become children of God. I don't know which voices are the ones you hear most often in your head, the voices that tell you how worthless you are, or the voices that are wanting to say there's something else about you that's more important than this right. Either way, before we walk back through the office door, why don't we just take a moment to pause, a moment just to look again at those words we've been looking at in verse 12 and ask the Spirit to speak them into our hearts and minds. Let's be still.